The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The state of New York's Joint Senate Task Force on Opioids, Addiction, and Overdose Prevention has been holding a series of public hearings and public meetings around the state to hear from stakeholders on strategies for reducing overdoses, improving individual and community health, and addressing the consequences of drug use. On today's show, we're going to hear from some of those witnesses. But first, the state of New York has finally eliminated cash bail. Major bail reform legislation was approved in 2019 and only just went into effect at the beginning of 2020. Opponents failed to stop bail reform from being approved, so now they're trying to overturn it. But supporters are working hard to keep reforms in place. On Tuesday, January 7th, New York City's public advocate Jemani Williams organized a rally to urge public support for bail reform. Here's New York City public advocate Jemani Williams. Audio is courtesy of CBS New York.
I can think of no clearer example of why these reforms were so critical than the fact that just a block behind us, Harvey Weinstein arrived for his trial today under his own power, while Akeem Browder is here because his brother Khalif couldn't afford to go home. Only about 10 to 12% of people in New York City jails have been convicted and sentenced. The rest are kept there not because they're dangerous, but because they're poor. Today we're at the courthouse to ensure that the new laws are being observed and followed in the courtroom. And it's important to verify that the laws are being acted in good faith because people are spreading myths and misinformation about these reforms after the fact in order to try and claw back the progress that is made. I have been sorely disappointed to see lawmakers in the highest parts of this state and in this city and attorneys and DAs speaking as if they don't understand what bail was for and what bail was not for. I want to caution everyone now who is trying to claw back these wins that there are many people decades later apologizing for the crime bill, apologizing for three strikes and you're out, apologizing for the abuses of stop, question, and frisk. They have the courage of hindsight. They have the courage of looking back and saying we were wrong. We have the ability to show leadership and vision right now. These calls often happen in times of fear, in times where people are feeling fearful. We make these knee-jerk and rash decisions in a response, oftentimes pandering to the fears that people have. Some of those fears are built in real things, and some of them are just a feeling. What I'm asking people to do is have the courage of leadership. No one here wants people to be hurt. No one here wants people to be violent. And I will say this. The people who did the most work on bail reforms live in the communities where the people are going to come back home from. They don't want their families in danger. How dare you continue to risk the brown and black bodies of people simply to cater to people who are afraid? This is a time of leadership. This is a time of unity. And to see people using the fear of anti-Semitism to deal with bail reform is disgusting. Anti-Semitism needs to be addressed. It's been on the rise for the past year or two. It's horrible. Bail reform has been around for 6 days. Where is the correlation? If you want to have a discussion about remand, let's have that discussion. That has nothing to do with bail reform. The fact that people keep talking about bail reform and remand together is proving the point that all of these people were making in the first place. Judges were abusing bail to hold black and brown people in jail.
That audio again was courtesy of CBS New York. You just heard Jamani Williams, public advocate for the city of New York, speaking at a rally on Tuesday, January 7th. He and many others were there to support bail reforms that have just gone into effect in the state of New York. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Well, let's stay in New York, shall we? The New York State Joint Senate Task Force on Opioids, Addiction, and Overdose Prevention has been holding a series of public hearings and public meetings around the state to hear from stakeholders on strategies for reducing overdoses, improving individual and community health, and addressing the consequences of drug use. The most recent of these public hearings was in Albany, New York. We're going to hear from some of the witnesses. First up, let's hear from Ronald Anderson. He's a person with lived experience and a leader at the Cattell Center for Health, Equity, and Justice.
My name is Ron. I'm 57 years old. I've been in Albany for 17 years. I have five kids here. I was 15 when I started using drugs, and my first arrest was in 1979. I went upstate for the first time in 1981. After that, I had two more prison visits and 41 arrests, most of which were drug-related. Being on opioids, and I wouldn't be treated, knowing that I wouldn't be treated for opioids, I would go into prison under mental health to get some type of drug to help fight this withdrawal. Because my tolerance dropped, I would overdose. When I would come home, I would overdose. And thankfully, I had friends that were always there to take me to the hospital or bring me a biopic. My drug use has always been due to depression, loss of hope, and homelessness. It has never been because I'm a bad person. In my experience, though, every time I tried to get help, I was either refused or offered help where I didn't need it. All of this kept me using, and even it kept me using even more, which then made everything else worse. It was a vicious cycle. Hustle, cop, use. Hustle, cop, use. That was it. I lost even more hope. I wasn't given the proper help, and instead, I was repeatedly sent back to prison. I was in treatment. They came in, because I had a dirty urine, parole came into treatment and put the cuffs on me, took me back to prison. I want to be clear that treating me or anyone like me as a criminal has never worked, and it will never work, you know? I watched a lot of movies, and one of my favorite movies, and it's a saying, it's called Fury, and he says, the war will end soon, but before it does, a lot more people has to die. Change that. Mm-hmm. Prevent overdose. Overdose prevention. Please change that today. You know, this morning coming here, a friend drove me over here and had my kids in this car, and drop them off at the bus to go to school. And as I was coming in across the street from the bus stop here, they said, "Get him, Dad." Get him, Dad. Wow. You know, I joined Cattell, and they told me that I can make a difference. I said, how? I'm useless. He said, no, you're not. Stop thinking like that, man. You know what I mean? Tell the people, we're gonna take you to where the people are who can make the changes, and that's you.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So I'm just saying, help us, man. Please. Give us that chance. Meet us where we are. They keep telling me, you need this, you need that. I ain't ready. When I became ready, instead of looking for a handout, Cattell gave me a hand up. So I'm just asking you to help us to continue that fight for the people, so people don't have to suffer like I did. You know, you can't ease my pain and suffering by making me suffer more, by sending me back to prison. You can't change that. I love being in my children's life, but I can't if I'm violated But not a new crime. Not because I did somebody else wrong. Because I used. Because I have a sickness. Because you refuse to help me. Lock him up. He's an animal.
That sure ain't right.
No, not one more. No more death. You can prevent that. Health and harm reduction. Invest in that. Health care. You can help us. And we need that help. Thank you.
That was Ronald Anderson, a leader at the Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice, testifying at a public hearing of New York State's Joint Senate Task Force on Opioids, Addiction, and Overdose Prevention. Let's hear now from Courtney Lavelle, co-founder of Our Wellness Collective.
Good morning. As a child, I suffered abuse. I had repeated early adverse childhood experiences that went largely unaddressed. By 7 years old, I suffered with such intense night terrors and sleepwalking, I needed to be sedated at night. My mother and stepfather did the best they could with what they had. A convenience store worker and a farmer, they didn't have much.
I'm sorry, ma'am, just for the record, if you could identify yourself so that we can put your name underneath you.
Courtney Lavelle.
Thank you, miss.
I tried hard to hide the pain throughout most of my life. After all of my attempts failed to fix the broken pieces inside of myself, it would only make sense that I eventually found the one form of dissociation that actually worked to numb my emotional pain. I became addicted to opiates by 16, an intravenous drug user by 17, and by 18 I was racking up an extensive criminal record. No school intervened, no therapy saved me, attempts at treatment failed, and at 19, with my mother at home dying from a terminal cancer, I gave up. I had no hope. I had no more fight left in me. I felt completely alone with nowhere to go. I felt the world would be better off without me in it. So I drove to a back road not very far from here and decided to end my life by overdose. But for some reason...
Take your time, man.
I'm one of the few who got to wake back up. After some grueling time detoxing without any medication or compassion in jail, I was afforded treatment court, long-term residential and outpatient treatment, endless forms of cognitive therapy, and eventually even recovery supports. I was able to get my criminal record sealed as a youthful offender, so my felony charges disappeared completely. I was able to go back to school and get a good job as an addictions counselor. I was able to gain security clearance and work on a contract with our Department of Defense to help build the first ever substance abuse prevention program for our soldiers. I volunteered most of my free time. I got married. I started my own family. I bought a house. I paid taxes. I began to vote. I was asked by our governor to sit on his opioid task force and travel the state. I was invited to the White House twice. I started my own business. I became an author. I became an intricate and valued member of my community and our society. The same society who would not even look that 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old version of me in the eyes because I was just another no-good criminal drug addict who wasn't worth it. The same society who only valued me when I was finally able to stop using substances. The same society who tells people just like me every single day that they do not deserve medical care, sterile supplies to inject with, safe spaces to not overdose in, nor a welcoming spot within it. No, they say I must first do away with the only means that ever quelled that crippling pain, trust perfect strangers to not victimize me further, and endure all of the physiological and psychologically painful phases of a brain recalibrating to the sudden loss of its only ability to produce dopamine. Then, if and when we can somehow make our way through it, that same society calls us criminals. It bars us from education, housing, and jobs with records and cold stares and cruel whispers of wasted taxpayer dollars. As one of far too few people who have managed to army crawl through the impossible sludge of hatred and judgment and shame and ridicule and laws and red tape and meek moral arguments, while many, many more have died around me, today I am one of those taxpayers. Those are my dollars. I have the right to tell you the best way to help me and all those other versions of me with my money. I'll keep it simple. Why is New York trying to cut funding to children's mental health services? It is morally incomprehensible to be cutting children's mental health services at this time. We need to be increasing funding to children's mental health services so that we can intervene before these issues develop into substance use disorder and suicide. We need to provide medical care and harm reduction services to the versions of me that are out there right now still actively using. Care for them. Look them in their eyes and tell them they are worth our acknowledgement right now. Not at some elusive point they may never reach, but right now. Change laws, fight whatever lawsuits you need to, and open overdose prevention sites. There is plenty of peer-reviewed research that shows these sites cut down on crime, prevent 100% of overdose deaths, and increase linkages to treatment. The only moral argument that matters in this discussion is the one that says, I have a moral issue with letting people die a preventable death while we have evidence-based solutions to prevent them. Thank you.
That was Courtney Lavelle, co-founder of Our Wellness Collective, testifying before a public hearing of New York State's Joint Senate Task Force on Opioids, Addiction, and Overdose Prevention. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear now from Keith Brown, Director of Health and Harm Reduction at the Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice.
I'm Keith Brown, Director of Health and Harm Reduction with the Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice. Thank you for having me. You have my testimony in front of you, so I'm just hoping to expound on some of these points here a little bit. So I first want to say that we have to be really deliberate about talking differently about what we're in right now. I've heard the term opioid epidemic brought up several times, opioid crisis brought up a few times. We are not in an opioid crisis. We're in a crisis of what the CDC has called deaths of despair. Opioid deaths and other drug fatalities are the symptom, not the disease. And I want to be really clear about this because this is really important about how we address this moving forward, because we can't keep playing a whack-a-mole game with substances when that's not actually the issue. Yes, obviously opioids have been contributing towards overdose deaths, but most overdose deaths are actually polysubstance use related. People are dying of cocaine overdoses. People are dying of methamphetamine overdoses. People are dying from alcohol. Our drug supply is poisoned, right, by benzodiazepines, fentanyl, right? We have to be really clear that this is a crisis of housing, of inadequate housing. It's a crisis of income inequality. This is why they say that these are deaths of despair. This is a crisis of healthcare. People do not have adequate healthcare. So I say this because when we call this an opioid crisis or an opioid epidemic, it leaves certain people out of the equation when we talk about it that way. I'm sure you're going to hear about racial equity from my, I'm incredibly grateful to be on this panel with these two strong black women who are going to tell you exactly what's up after this. But we're leaving people out of this conversation. We're leaving people out of this thing. And the narrative has been that white folks in the suburbs are dying and now we got to do something about this. And we need to be really clear that these are the chickens coming home to roost from the drug war that's been largely impacting black and brown people and poor people since it was started. And we have to name that. It's now only because white kids from the suburbs started dying that folks are saying, we have to take a different approach to this thing. We should have done it then. We have to do it now. Otherwise, there's going to be another round of substances that people are dying from, and we're going to be ill-equipped to handle it. We have to invest in the things that we know work right now. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that most people who actually start their use on a prescription opioid, it has not been prescribed to them. This is really clear. To say that we have to crack down on prescription opioids at this point in the crisis is ridiculous. That ship sailed. And what is happening, though, is people with intractable chronic pain are being forced tapered or cut off from their medications. They're turning to the illicit market that we know is poisoned with fentanyl, and they're dying of overdoses because they can't get their pain managed. Some of these folks are even committing suicide from pain. So we can't leave them out of the equation either. So I just want to name that. That is really misguided to actually focus on that, right? Just to be clear, those were not medications prescribed to those folks. That's what the data shows overwhelmingly. So what we have to do practically, I've been working with people who use drugs for my entire career. I've lost people close to me. I have family members, right, who struggle with addiction. I started my career in HIV. I saw how racial disparities and other disparities impacted that population of folks, right? And I'm tired of this. And the answer is actually staring us right in the face.
That's right.
You cannot treat substance use as a health issue under the specter of criminalization and prohibition. You cannot do it. We have to decriminalize use and possession of all substances, and we need to divest from law enforcement, incarceration, and all those other tools. And we can invest in health, we can invest in housing, we can invest in the things that we know work. Because this is a very important point. Regardless of the fact that there are people who believe so, increased penalties and increased enforcement does not actually lead to reductions in drug use, reductions in drug-related deaths, or reductions in crime. It doesn't actually work. We've just been led to believe that it does work. And I would challenge us as New Yorkers to be the New Yorkers we have a reputation for being. And we need to bootstrap each other. We need to protect our family, our friends, our community members. We need to be the one showing the rest of the country that we can do this thing different. In the meantime, here are the things I would really encourage you to do. Decriminalize possession of syringes now, right now. Put significant investments into harm reduction programs, at least at the level that you're doing so with treatment, period. Fund the AIDS Institute. I know it's weird, but that's where the Office of Drug User Health lies. Those folks need money. They've actually been experiencing cuts. We can't do that. There needs to be a separate line for naloxone funding so those state agencies don't have to take it out of their budget. We need to authorize overdose prevention centers 10 years ago. Not this year, not last year, 10 years ago. It's ridiculous that we don't have them. I'm sorry, I'm wrapping up. Mm-hmm. Low threshold medication treatment in all settings, including in corrections. The fact that that bill didn't pass last year is really, really just unconscionable. We need to do less is more and reform our parole system now. Now, locking people up for parole violations for substance use is not appropriate. Decriminalize sex work now. Repeal the ban, the walking while trans ban for our trans brothers and sisters. No more solitary confinement. Pass halt solitary this year. And do not yield an inch on bail reform, please.
Thank you, sir.
And listen to people who use drugs.
Thank you, sir.
That was Keith Brown, Director of Health and Harm Reduction at the Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice. He was testifying before New York State's Joint Senate Task Force on Opioids, Addiction, and Overdose Prevention. Let's hear from Deanna King, Policy Manager at the Drug Policy Alliance.
Good afternoon. My name is Deanna King, and I'm the New York State Policy Manager with the Drug Policy Alliance. I've had the pleasure of attending multiple public hearings convened by this task force and have had learned from those working to end the current overdose crisis and prevent needless drug-related deaths. Policy proposals that were once considered political anathema are now the center of discourse as policymakers and legislative leaders continue to see the value of harm reduction. Overdose prevention sites, syringe exchanges, or no threshold medication maintenance and supportive housing are all effective interventions. And if New York State commits to sustained investment in developing a harm reduction infrastructure, lives can be saved. I've also witnessed multiple service providers and physicians discuss the impact of stigma and stress an urgent need to change the narrative regarding drug use and addiction. This is vital, and I want to plainly say that we cannot erode stigma, we cannot fully commit to harm reduction if we continue to criminalize and incarcerate people who use drugs. I implore the members of this task force to put forth the policy agenda that makes the case for removing drug use from the purview of the criminal legal system, and instead center on other avenues for engaging with people who use drugs in a way that reinforces their humanity and their individual needs. Drug arrests across the state fell precipitously following the Rockefeller drug law reforms. However, New Yorkers can still be arrested for felony and misdemeanor drug offenses. In 2018, there were over 20,000 felony drug arrests in New York, with the majority of those arrests for possession of meager quantities of controlled substances or low-level sales. While 20,000 is a dramatic decline considering New York's role in mass incarceration, the current overdose crisis should force lawmakers to reckon with the impact of criminalization on access to healthcare, housing, employment, and other social determinants to health that have an effect on substance use disorder. The social environment in which people engage in substance use impacts their overall health and influences drug users' risk behaviors. Incarceration in and of itself negatively impacts an individual's health, and for those experiencing opioid dependency, the cycle of release and reentry contributes to an increase in morbidity and mortality. Portugal's model of drug decriminalization is touted as a global model success. Portugal shifts drug towards drug decriminalization, effectively curb the transmission of HIV, and removing criminal penalties for drug possession was a component of a plan that emphasized low or no threshold treatment access and robust harm reduction infrastructure. New York State has taken steps towards providing alternatives to incarceration and a drug treatment service is allocated through judicial diversion programs, but the state has failed to fully divest from criminalization. And to what end? Judicial diversion, jail-based treatment, or other forms of coercive or other coercive forms of treatment do not have to be the sole driver connecting people to healthcare systems. In 2001, Portugal ceased criminalizing drug use, and the results have been dramatic. The number of people voluntarily entering treatment has increased significantly, while overdose deaths, HIV infections, and problematic drug use and incarceration for drug-related offenses have plummeted. Drug decriminalization has had a remarkable impact on the overdose death rate. In 1999, Portugal recorded 369 drug overdose deaths. By 2015, that number had fallen to 54. Subjecting individuals who experience substance use disorder or use drugs non-problematically to incarceration or contact with the criminal legal systems does nothing to mitigate the harms of problematic substance use. Law enforcement interventions exacerbate the overdose epidemic. People who are subjected to law enforcement interaction can be rendered vulnerable to conditions that weaken their civil liberties and the social and economic connections that create stability and recovery capital. Materially, incarceration and judicial diversion programs isolate individuals from harm reduction and treatment resources that reduce the risk associated with drug use, such as disease transmission. The threat of law enforcement diminishes the effectiveness of strong public health laws, such as Good Samaritan law and syringe decriminalization. It is for these reasons the Drug Policy Alliance, the United Nations, and the World Health Organization support the repeal of laws that criminalize drug use and possession of drugs for personal use. Additionally, the UNA strategy firmly declared that drug decriminalization is necessary if we are to fully protect people who use drugs from social and legal environments that fail to protect people against discrimination. I want to conclude by naming some of the things that have been brought up as I've been making my rounds through these hearings. I've heard drug courts brought up a number of times as a solution, and I want to be really clear that we can't replace criminalization with drug courts. It's the same thing. In drug courts, we see judges acting as treatment providers making decisions for people's health. We're seeing people taking off their medication-assisted treatment. We're seeing people having longer sentences than they would have had initially had they just taken whatever case that was presented to them and having to stay in a drug court setting longer than their original case would have allowed. We're seeing people in family court being made to be abstinent only, to not be giving any harm reduction resources, to have their kids be used as collateral when they're trying to get their lives back together, to try to recover from substance use disorder. And we can't expand this system, but we're trying to get out of the overdose crisis. I've also heard coercive treatment and 72-hour holds be brought up as a solution, and we can't take away people's civil liberties as a response to the drug crisis. New York State Department of Health or New York City Department of Health has put forward a pilot program called Relay, where they have peers acting as first responders in a hospital setting and have a number of recommendations that I made here. But I want to stress the fact that we need to decriminalize all drugs now. Like, that is the way that we get out of this overdose crisis. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
That was Deanna King, policy manager at the Drug Policy Alliance, testifying before New York State's Joint Senate Task Force on Opioids, Addiction, and Overdose Prevention. And that's it for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.